Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. And today, we have a special episode, a summer catch-up episode. The Future of Political Consulting has pulled a highlight from each of our previous episodes. You'll hear insights from top industry experts on a range of topics that cover campaign influencer collaborations, voter engagement strategies, and the impact of AI. Enjoy! In our very first episode, From Memes to Movements Inside the Campaign Influencer Collaboration, Ryan Davis sat with Kelly Gibson and discussed the benefit of recruiting a social media normie.
There are different kinds of influencers. There are influencers who really talk about politics. They talk about, they're Democrats, they talk about that. They're Republicans, they're Trump supporters, they talk about that. And those folks are leaning in as much as they can. And then there are sort of what I call the normies, who are people who are, they vote, they might express a political opinion or talk about an issue occasionally, but the vast majority of their content is about whatever else their sort of niche is, travel, life, medical, et cetera. And so I think those folks are the harder to get, the normies, because they definitely feel that, hey, if I come out on this controversial issue, I'm going to piss off 50% of the population. But they're also the most powerful messengers because they don't obviously have a side. So it's definitely easier to recruit those folks who are overtly political in their content. But if you can take the time to onboard a creator who doesn't talk about politics most of the time, I think that is where the real impact can lie.
So fewer Taylor Swifts and more suburban moms with weeknight recipes.
So suburban moms are the best. Yeah, absolutely.
In the final stretch, Finding the Voters will flip the script. Jackie Huelbig and Paul Westcott look at an evolution in voter engagement.
Looking at today's landscape, there are a ton of innovations and turning points and changes in the way that we reach voters. Can you pinpoint a specific technology or a moment in your last 10 years at L2 where you say, wow, this is going to change the way we use this file, or this is going to change the way our clients target people?
Yeah, there's been revolutions in technology. I would say, you know, one you just mentioned, which is the visualization. So having the ability to visualize, make selections, and then be able to see on a map. And this isn't just L2. I mean, well, I've seen practitioners take even our file and put it into an OpenGIS or something like that, where they're able to map and visualize and sort of see heat maps of exactly where their voters are. And that's, being able to do that is something that really tells a story that you may not be able to get from a spreadsheet, right? So that's going to be a huge change in technology. And I highly recommend it. Even if you're not working with us, go look on a map, look and see where people are, and you might be surprised with some of the results in your district. The other piece is really the sort of offline to online technology bridge that's been gapped. I mean, L2 started with LiveRamp in 2015. We were the first voter file onboarded with them. And basically having an onboard to be able to distribute the data to, you know, at the time, dozens and now hundreds of different platforms is really something that was unique. And now it's, you have to be there because it's what consumer marketers are doing and other things like that. But in the political space, it was certainly novel at the time. But to be able to take this really important raw material we have in politics, which is the voter file, and make it digitally targetable and accessible was, that's revolutionary. And I think that watching the evolution of that over the next 5 to 10 years is going to be very interesting as well, with a combination of regulations meeting new technologies.
During the Future of Political Strategy in the Disinformation Era, journalist and political strategist Sasha Eisenberg reveals the best way to respond to an attack online.
To wrap this up, are there any insights that you have that you believe that hold a special lesson for consultants today?
Yeah, I think that the impulse has been always respond to an attack. You know, I think there's scenes in like the war room and stuff of, you know, Carville or Bagala like imploring people like don't leave an attack unanswered. It's certainly like Democrats after the Swift boat thing, the lesson in 2004 was, you know, don't leave an attack unanswered. This is sort of like comms 101. Often the right answer online is do not respond to something. 99% of the time seeing something online the correct answer is ignore it. It is probably not getting in front of persuadable voters in any significant way on an issue that will hurt you. It'll hurt your candidate, your issue, your campaign. That is, now 1% of the time it will, and you need to figure out how to respond without making the problem worse. But you need to have the confidence in 99% of the time that you're going to go back to your candidate or you know, the committee or whatever and say, we can't respond to this. And often that's a difficult thing to say because the politician's ego is involved. It seems like you're being reluctant to defend their honor or whatever it would be. But you're more likely to make the problem worse by rashly reacting to the wrong things than you are by ignoring them. And so having a sense, and I think we get this as a simple fact about offline life. If I told you, like, there are two guys at the end of a bar at a VFW hall in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, who are saying some things about your candidate that aren't fair, you'd go like, well, that's not, but you're not going to say like, okay, we're going to go put out a press release saying that, like, you know, Jimmy Bob and Jacqueline and Oshkosh are wrong. Here are all the reasons. Why wouldn't you do that? Because you're only going to elevate them and draw attention to it. Like, that's self-evident in the offline world. There are five people in a park who are holding signs saying with some conspiracy theory, you wouldn't think like, okay, we need to do a press conference. That would be like self-evidently crazy. But people do the equivalent of that in digital because they don't have the right sense of proportion or context when an attack comes. So don't feel the need to respond right away.
In an episode presented by AAPC's New York chapter, exploring the realignment of the American electorate with Patrick Ruffini, Patrick answers the question whether or not he thinks the most recent realignment of the GOP has longevity.
I think it's pretty durable, but maybe not in the sense you're thinking about, in the sense of, you know, when we talk about realignments, there's a type of realignment where you talk about it from the perspective of one party is sort of dominant over a generation or over, at least a period of a few election cycles. And I really go out of my way to not try and make that claim or not try even make that prediction, right? Because, I mean, I think anytime any book previously to this has tried to say that, it's always the next election. It's like a curse, right? The party loses the remainder. It's on the remainder bin, for the fast track to the remainder bin. But I do think, like, in terms of the changing nature of the internal nature of the coalition, I think it's a pretty damn durable change, because you're seeing it all around the world. You see it in other countries, in the rise of more populist right-wing parties in Western Europe, that the entire sort of architecture of conservative right-wing politics in a lot of places is more and more driven, you know, along this class realignment, where, you know, it's just increasingly based within the working classes, it's increasingly based in the politics of, you know, people who are lower income, more working class, whatnot. So I think from that perspective, if you're looking at the Republican primary election in 2028 and moving forward, it's just a different electorate than what we would have had in 2012, what we would have had in 2008, just fundamentally.
In Data-Driven Politics with Sarah Fagan, Sarah discusses machine learning and imagines future applications.
We have somebody, we had a guy on our team kind of playing around with a model with our audience set, you know, was able basically to pull in anything on any image on the internet and create an audience to target it. So, like, there's a coat at Nordstrom and you could pull it in, and based on the description of the coat and the price point, you know, you could have a completely computer generated audience to go target that, just as that's like something that's coming, I think. Whereas you in the future, you'll sort of see, we upload the ad and based on the language, the candidate, the party, the imagery, you could build an audience automatic. Now, campaigns have decided if they want to turn that much power over to technology.
In our two-part series, Women's Role in Shaping Future Elections, both Dr. Jennifer Lawless and Larissa Martinez discussed incorrect preconceptions and the benefits of working with female clients.
I mean, it seems to me that the two big misperceptions out there, and I think that this is true for female candidates too, is the idea that it's much more difficult for women to raise money than men. And we know that at the end of the day, when you look at the campaign receipt totals, they're the same. Now, the sources might be a little bit different. It might be that it takes more phone calls to get that maximum contribution for a woman than a man, although I haven't seen systematic data on that. Okay. But the reality is, if that's the case, then women are even better than men at raising the money because they're making more of those calls to get the same number of dollars, right? And so I think sharing that information also, the same way that, you know, media coverage, as you know, in congressional races, for example, and certainly in down ballot races, local news is still the way that people get their information. And it's not about going on CNN. It's not about going on Fox News. It's about talking to the one local reporter who still works at your local newspaper. And Danny Hayes and I have done systematic analyses of local news coverage in midterm elections. And in terms of the volume and the substance of coverage, in terms of the specific traits mentioned in relation to a candidate, the specific issues mentioned in relation to a candidate, whether the candidate's appearance is ever mentioned, we found no gender differences. And so I think women also go in with this expectation that the media are going to be harder on them, that they're going to have to work harder to get coverage, that that coverage is not going to reflect what the campaign is about. And there's just not evidence of that either. Now, at the national level, that might be a different story in presidential politics. But, you know, the same way that we shouldn't be looking at the decision to run through a national lens, I think a lot of what candidates know or think they know about fundraising or media coverage is based on what they see nationally too. So to the extent that we can debunk those myths.
I feel like there's this weird kind of, I'm going to say, old viewpoint that women are more of a risk, or that they don't raise as much money, or that they don't win as often. And I think the polls have showed that over the past several cycles, like that's not necessarily true. They win just as much when they jump in. They raise just as much when they jump in, but they need to feel prepared and confident and ready to go, which is why, again, having pipelines, I mean, WPLN is part of that and the work that we do. And it is a lot of work. I'm not going to lie. It's a lot of work to get there. But women, when they get there, they do raise money. They tend to involve the community. Their approach to leadership, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or Republican, is one of problem solving. They actually want to, you know, really find solutions for their communities, which helps continue to push on the narrative that women are good in leadership positions. I mean, it's a full cycle. And the more women that you have in the pipeline running and winning and leading once they get there, the easier it's going to be to continue to pull them in and continue to see these diverse perspectives at decision-making tables. So to the consultants, yes, there may be a lot at the front end, but the return is still there. Mm-hmm. And if anything, a pipeline allows for more return.
Our two most recent episodes dealt with AI and its role in the industry. First, from the future of media production with Melanie McGee. We'll hear Melanie discuss why a client might not want to utilize AI just yet. And then, from Next Gen Strategy, inside Political Consulting's AI evolution, you'll hear from Blaine Wallace and how he believes AI will affect consultants.
So it was, the client was willing to take a chance on using a medium, you know, using a method that they hadn't really used before, and they were very pleased with the results. But it was, you know, that was one of the few times AI was floated. A few other times it was suggested, but never had landed on the concept that the candidate or the client wanted to follow through on. So it can be useful, and it's good in terms of communicating themes, I think, overall. But in terms of showing representation of people, there's still a lot of work that AI has to do for it to be realistic. And so we opted to just go with like visual themes as opposed to using AI to create those visual themes in terms of the look and what people were wearing and using, as opposed to seeing their faces. So we didn't have to try to say, well, this is what a North Dakota person looks like. This is what a North Dakota voter looks like, or this is what a North Dakota politician looks like. You know what I mean?
I definitely think that it's going to continue to get more broadly integrated into people's workflows. Like I said earlier, you know, the vast majority of consultants used it, and the majority of them liked using it. They thought it was beneficial to their work. And, you know, it's, I feel like every week something new comes out, something gets improved. And I think that's just going to keep happening. One of the notes from the IDIs that we did is a lot of people definitely felt that it wasn't something that's going to, you know, revolutionize the industry or dramatically transform the way it works, but instead it's going to be a tool that's going to help them do their jobs more effectively. One of the things that came up, you know, is it's going to help take the monotonous, mundane day-to-day tasks that a lot of consultants, especially the senior consultants who, you know, spend a lot of time on calls and actually creating output, they don't want to do, or they don't have the time to do. So it's going to take those tasks off their plate so they're able to spend time doing things that they actually want to do and is more valuable. So I think in terms of just making it easier, giving consultants more time, not on the things that they don't want to be doing, giving consultants more time for doing the things they want to do, I should say.
Thank you for listening to our summer catch-up. Be sure to go back and listen to the full episode so you can really immerse yourself in the conversations. And subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join in on the conversation by following us on social media at the AAPC. Thanks for listening.